This Janet Mefford Today podcast is sponsored by Heart for Lebanon, the Christian ministry working among 2 million Syrian refugee families who've been displaced. For just $29 a month, you can help Heart for Lebanon reach out in Jesus' name to a family of six, providing them with food, Christian education, survival essentials, and the gospel. Please call now, 888-247-5499. That's 888-247-5499 or janetmefford.com.
This is Janet Mefford Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Mefford.
Thank you so much for joining us again. It was great news in 2018 when Pastor Andrew Brunson, who had been held for 2 years in Turkish prisons under false accusations of aiding terrorism, was released and returned home to the United States. This came after intervention from the Trump administration and a prayer campaign that involved thousands of people like us asking the Lord for his merciful intervention. But as you can imagine, there is much more to the story of what the Lord did in his life than what many of us have heard on the news. And Pastor Brunson is here to talk about it, as is outlined in his new memoir. It's called God's Hostage, A True Story of Persecution, Imprisonment, and Perseverance. Pastor Brunson, it's wonderful to have you with us. So glad you could join us.
Hi, thanks.
Well, it's great to talk to you. You know, I have to say right away when I was going through your book, you had a sense of missionary calling, you say, that went all the way back to your childhood. And I've talked to a lot of missionaries through the years who said the same thing. But your story is very interesting. Can you talk a little bit about how it was you felt called to missions in the first place?
Well, I think this goes back to Hudson Taylor, who was a famous missionary to China. I can say famous.
Yes.
I grew up, he was one of my heroes. So when he was an old man, a woman took her two sons to him and said, asked him to lay hands on them and set them aside for missions. And he did that. And both of them grew up to become missionaries. And one of them, Stanley Salto, when he was an old man, my mother took me and my sister, my younger sister, to him and asked that he do the same. What Hudson Taylor did for you, I ask you to do for my children. So he laid hands on us and set us aside for missions. And I remember the day very well, even though I was maybe 3 years old. But I remember it because I got a spanking that day right after that. So it was just engraved in my mind, and I'm glad that happened. It's one of my earliest memories. And from that time, I always had a very clear sense, even though I went through in my teen years a time when I was not walking with the Lord at all. I was not a serious Christian. But if people would ask me, I would say, what are you going to do when you grow up? I'd say, if I survive this period of my life, I know I'm supposed to be a missionary. So it was very deeply ingrained in me.
That is amazing. So you will forever have that connection to Hudson Taylor. That's pretty awesome. It's really,
yes.
Now, you know, to go to Turkey, this is not the easiest mission field in the world, and especially that bore itself out through your experience with going to prison and being released eventually. But why was it that you eventually settled on going to Turkey? I know you were there for over two decades, but how did you end up there in the first place?
Well, we actually didn't want to go to Turkey. We wanted to go to Egypt, to the Arab world. And our church, the denomination we were with at the time, asked that we go to Turkey. So we did, reluctantly. When we got on the plane to fly over the first time, Noreen, my wife, was crying and just, my life is over. I'm going to a place I don't want to go. But in the first few years, we think God put some of the love he has for Turkey into our hearts, and we became very committed to see blessing come to that nation.
Yeah, that is a difficult field, for sure.
And it is the largest unevangelized country in the world. Most cities in Turkey do not have a church. Most Turks have never met a Christian in their lives. So it was a good place for us to go.
Do you feel like during the course of your ministry over there, for the most part, you were treated well? I know you share one story where you had to stop a gunman, for example, and that must have been terrifying. But generally speaking, how were Christians, how was your family received over there?
So the majority of Turks, the vast majority are Muslims. To be a Turk is to be a Muslim in their mindset. So they don't react to us as much because they expect that most Westerners are Christian, even though that's not the case. The Christianity they know is what they see from Hollywood on TV or on movies.
Right.
But especially for a Turkish believer who becomes a Christian, then there's a very strong reaction from the society, from the family. They're often disowned. So they have a lot of difficulty. Now, there are threats. for anybody who's, you know, trying to start a church in Turkey, there are going to be threats, and we did have a number of those over the years.
Sure.
But an interaction with normal people on the street and in relationships, yeah, they're warm and friendly people.
Right. Well, now we had that news of the coup attempt in 2016. There were purges taking place, and that was when things kind of went south for you in terms of your legal troubles and going to prison. Can you tell people a little bit about how that all started? Because you were summoned by the police, weren't you? They were looking for you, and you probably must have been a little bit confused. Why? What did I do?
We actually were happy to go to the police station when they called us in, because we thought we were going to pick up a long-term residence visa. So we were surprised when we got there and they said we were being deported. Now, after that, they did not deport us. They kept us. My wife and I were together for about 13 days in a detention center. And then they released her, but they kept me for the next 2 years in various places. So that is something that we did not expect at all. Some people, the U.S. government, especially in the first few months, they thought that I was just caught up in the chaos after the attempted coup. But it has become clear that that was not the case. This was targeted. They chose me, and then they chose to keep me long term to make me an example, I believe, to intimidate other missionaries and help them self-deport. Also to intimidate local Turkish Christians. The idea is, if we can do this to an American, we can do this to anybody.
Yeah.
So it wasn't a mistake. They very intentionally kept me and charged me with all kinds of ridiculous things.
Well, right. When they talked about the fact that they were accusing you of aiding terrorism, they attached you somehow to Fethullah Gulen. I am not probably pronouncing that name right, but that movement where you weren't involved in that. But what were some of the charges that they falsely lobbed at you? Because there were quite a few.
Well, the very serious ones, the most serious, were that I was that I helped to plan the attempted coup and tried to overthrow the government, and that brought 3 automatic life sentences without parole in solitary confinement. So, very serious charges. Also, military espionage. I was also accused officially of being part of the PKK, which is a Kurdish terror group.
Yes,
and also, as you mentioned, the Gulen group, which is an Islamist movement.
That is crazy. Did they have any evidence against you when they were trying to tie you to the attempted coup, or was it all just kind of kangaroo court stuff?
Oh, there was no evidence. And I mean, they accused me of a lot of other things, too, that I was a CIA spy in charge of the main CIA chief for Turkey, then for the whole Middle East, then that if I had been successful in the coup attempt, I was going to be made director of the whole CIA. They said I was running a Mormon church. Then they said I was ahead of the Jehovah's Witnesses, that I gave coordinates to the U.S. military to drop weapons to terrorists. There were all kinds of crazy things.
Oh, man, you're ahead of the Mormons and the Jehovah's Witnesses, even though you're a Christian.
There you go.
That's quite creative. Unbelievable.
Yes.
That's crazy. Well, now, did you know of other Christians who were going through similar things? I know they kind of were making an example of you, but was there other persecution that was going on against particular Christians that you knew of where you were, or just you?
I'm the only missionary who has been imprisoned in living memory. Now, there are a number of people who've been deported, and most of the problems that Turkish believers have come from the society rather than from a legal side. But I think that that is changing in Turkey. There is increasing tension, and there's a lot of hatred toward, I say, there's a lot more hate speech, which in Turkey often leads to violence. This is directed toward Christians. And it came through my case because they used me, basically the government drove a propaganda campaign. And they said, well, the things I've already mentioned, they accused me of. But on top of that, basically they were portraying me as an enemy of Turkey who wants to divide the country and as a traitor and wants to kill Turks and chop their heads off and all kinds of crazy things. So when they painted me with that brush, they were actually painting all of the believers in Turkey. They're traitors. They're not trustworthy. And now when and they hate Turkey, they're enemies of Turkey. So that when persecution does come, I think the majority of the population now is just going to say, well, the Christians deserve it, whatever they get.
Oh, my goodness. Well, we're going to go to a quick break. Pastor Andrew Brunson is with us talking about his new book, God's Hostage, A True Story of Persecution, Imprisonment, and Perseverance. We'll find out more when we come back. You're listening to Janet Mefford Today. Janet Mefford Today is proud to partner with Preborn to help save babies' lives.
Well, my name is Dan Steiner, and I'm the president of Preborn. Ultrasound truly is a game changer. When a mom comes into a pregnancy center under pressure to abort her child, perhaps the dad's gone, perhaps her mother is pressuring her. Most of the time in her heart, she doesn't want to abort, but what she needs is something that will give her the strength to choose life against the pressures that are forcing her to consider abortion. That's the ultrasound. If she hears her baby's heartbeat and sees that baby on ultrasound, everything's different.
Will you join us in saving babies' lives? Preborn funds pregnancy centers across the nation so they can offer free ultrasounds to women in crisis pregnancies. Ultrasound is a game changer because when abortion-minded women actually see their babies in their wombs for themselves, 80% of the time, they choose life. Would you please join us at Janet Mefford Today to support the ministry of Preborn? For $140, you can provide 5 free ultrasounds to women in crisis pregnancies. A gift of $22 will provide 1 ultrasound, and every gift helps. To donate, please call now, 855-402-BABY. That's 855-402-2229, or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. All gifts are tax deductible, and 100% of your gift goes directly towards saving babies. You can get involved, and you can help save a life for a gift of $140. 5 free ultrasounds will be offered to women in crisis pregnancies. Let's do more than talk about abortion. Let's save some lives. Please call now with your gift, 855-402-BABY. That's 855-402-BABY. 855-402-2229. Or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. We are back on Janet Mefford Today. Thank you for joining us. You know, you read the book of Acts and you see what the apostles went through suffering for the Lord. And Paul in particular talked about being in prison. These things are very removed for most of us. But my guest, Pastor Andrew Brunson, knows firsthand what it's like to suffer for the Lord. He was in prison, as most of us know, in Turkey, and through God's providence ended up being released. He's out with a book called God's Hostage, A True Story of Persecution, Imprisonment, and Perseverance. Pastor Brunson, you were talking a little bit about the false charges that were trumped up against you, how you ended up in prison. And I know a lot of people, especially Christians, are curious to know what it was like to be in a Turkish prison. I know you were moved around, but what was that experience like for you? Can you give us kind of a sense of what you went through?
Well, there were three things that especially, if I could remember what the three things are exactly, but one of them was the isolation. I was the only Christian. Often I was in cells with, well, everyone I celled with was Muslim, and I was in a very overcrowded cell, built for 8 people. There were over 20 of us in there, and there was constant Muslim prayers and chanting of the Quran, and I was the only Christian in that, in my cells and in the prisons throughout my imprisonment, throughout 2 years. So I was very isolated, and I also spent time in solitary confinement, which was very difficult for me. If they want to break people, they put them in isolation and sleep deprivation. And I was isolated, and my body was depriving me of sleep because of all the stress, all the adrenaline. Mm. So I lost 50 pounds in the first few months, just with a lot of panic. And then apart from the isolation, the sense of lack of clarity, I didn't know that they'd ever let me out. So everything was uncertain. As I mentioned before, they wanted 3 life sentences. So I didn't know if I'd ever get out to be with my children, see my wife again. So the third thing is there's a complete loss of hope.
Yeah.
And so those three areas, they really broke me. I would say, in the book that's just come out, this God's Hostage, I had read many biographies, and they're often heroic figures, you know, Christians who are my personal heroes, and they go through difficulties, and they're very strong in the biographies. So I expected, when I was in prison, I thought, well, I'm suffering for Jesus. I'm going to be filled with grace and joy and strength, even though it's difficult. But I will have this sense, supernatural presence around me. And I expected to sense the presence of God as I had before I was in prison. But what I experienced was more the silence of God. And all of these things brought together took me into spiritual crisis, and I had a lot of doubts and questions.
Oh, my.
So I was broken.
Yeah.
But the story isn't just brokenness, it's that actually God rebuilt me. So that's a very important. I want to focus on that. I was broken and weak, but God did something amazing through my imprisonment.
Well, you know, that's a really important point to make, because I think a lot of us who have enjoyed Christian biographies and read a lot of these martyrs, you know, people who've suffered for Christ, I think you mentioned Richard Wurmbrand, for example, and people like that, and they have such victorious stories. But, you know, when you go through it, I'm sure it's a very different experience. How was it that you think God did rebuild you? Because you talk about after the fact, you miss that intimacy with God. Nobody would want to go through what you went through, but there was a special intimacy there with the Lord that isn't necessarily there in normal circumstances, I would imagine.
Yeah, it's something that has surprised me, actually, because what I experienced was silence of God, and I felt, you know, betrayal and abandonment. But as I've come out of it, I've come out with a deeper sense of intimacy than I had before. So the silence of God took me into a different relationship. And I think the what happened is that my love for God and my loyalty for God were tested. And before they were sincere and completely, you know, they were true and real. But after they're tested, then it's a proven love.
Right.
It's a proven obedience. And that just takes me deeper into his heart. I think what turned things around, my strength, even at my strongest, is still pretty weak. But what God did was, as I took steps toward him, I made a decision with my will, not with my feelings. My feelings were just a mess. But with my will, I said, I am going to fight for my relationship with God, because it was being suffocated by all my questions, doubts. And I was just sliding away. And I decided, I am going to turn to God, and I'm going to fight for my faith and for my relationship with God, because if I lose my relationship with him, then I've lost everything.
Yeah.
And so I began to fight, to focus myself on him, and to submit myself, to submit my will to him day after day.
That's,
so to turn my face toward him. Do I turn my face toward him or away from him?
Right.
And we all have a choice in our difficulties, whether we have the silence of God or whatever our struggle is, we turn toward him or we turn away from him. And as I turned toward him, then he met me in my weakness. And it was step after step, little victory after little victory, that then took me on an upward trajectory.
He is so faithful. And I remember when I first heard about your story, I started praying for you. I know we all were in the listening audience. People were calling and people were talking about you. You know that. You know that there were thousands, if not millions of people, Christians throughout the world praying for you. When did you begin to learn that there were plans underway by the Trump administration to try to get you out? How did that kind of go down, and how did you get word about that?
So there were the Trump administration engaged at a high level early on. And what was really frightening was when they engaged at such a high level. In May of 2017, President Trump had a summit with President Erdogan of Turkey, and he requested my release three times in that meeting. And then things got worse. And so I thought, things have gone as high as they can, humanly speaking, all the way to the president. And they're not releasing me. And actually, I was kept for another 17 months after that summit. So I was glad to hear all the political steps, diplomatic steps that the U.S. government was taking. But I still didn't know if it would accomplish my release in the end.
Right. Didn't you end up in his
prayer movement? Yeah. I wanted to say the prayer movement is, I came to see that my time in prison was an assignment from God, because there are two stories. One is the human side with all of the political intrigue and the Turkish government persecuting me. And the other side is that behind all of this political intrigue, God, I think of him as the grandmaster chess player. And he was raising up. There were actually millions of people around the world. I became a magnet of prayer, a magnet for prayer. And millions of people who I think wouldn't have been able to find Turkey on the map before began to pray for me. And that prayer was intended for Turkey to bring blessing and to prepare the conditions for a powerful move of God. So I came to see that actually, although it was Erdogan, the president of Turkey, who imprisoned me and kept me, that really God was taking what they intended to harm me, and he was turning it into good.
That's so neat. Yeah, and you mentioned in the book that when you went to the White House and all of us watched you there with President Trump, and then you kneeled down and prayed for the president. But that, you say in the book, that was the chair he sat in, right? Erdogan sat in that chair that you were in.
I remember in Turkish prison, I was watching on their news shows how President Erdogan was sitting in that yellow chair next to President Trump in the Oval Office. And that's when the president asked for my release. When President Trump three times sent Andrew Brunson home, and Erdogan hardened his heart and he refused to let me go, kept me another 17 months after that. And then when we went to the Oval Office, that's where President Trump told me to sit. I thought, wow, this is really appropriate. And the way God turns things around, that now I'm sitting at that same chair.
That's incredible. What was it like when you finally got out of prison? What was going through your head when you were heading home? I mean, it must have been just sheer elation, but probably some surprise, right? Given the fact that you were facing three life sentences, you didn't ever know if you really would be released.
So I went to my fourth trial session and they moved to convict me. And so I thought, I mean, I lost all hope there. And it was a real roller coaster. It was a few hours of hell for us, because I thought all of the pressure that has come against the Turkish government, and their economy had taken a very strong hit because of this. And they're still going to convict me, and they're going to sentence me to prison. So they convicted me of terror crimes, and then they sentenced me to prison. And then I kind of faded out. I was thinking, where will they send me? How will this work? I hope they put me back in the same cell so I don't have to start over again. And then I suddenly hear, you're free to go now. And you can leave the country. And I was astounded. So I went from being convicted of terrorism, sentenced to prison, to suddenly they say, you can go. And the rush to the airport to get on an Air Force plane that would get us out of Turkey before the president changed his mind, the president of Turkey, because any tweet or any comment that he didn't like could send me back to prison. And then when we finally got out of Turkish airspace, it was, whoa, this is real. I'm free now. So within 24 hours or so, I went from being convicted in a Turkish court to the White House. And that's just a roller coaster of emotions. And I felt almost detached from it all. It was so surreal.
I can imagine.
But it's so God, too,
yeah.
from conviction for terror right to the White House.
It's an amazing story, and especially when you get into all the details that you share in the book and some of the details that you shared here, because it's really an encouragement, I would say, to the rest of us in the body of Christ as well, because we were the ones praying for you. And when the Lord answered that prayer, it was like, thank you, Lord, because we wanted that so much. And we are just delighted that he did that for you. Pastor Andrew Brunson, you've got to read the book, God's Hostage. And God bless you so much, Pastor Brunson. It's just an honor to talk to you.
Thank you, and thank you to all who prayed for me.
Absolutely. It was our delight. Thank you. We'll be back on Janet Mefford Today. This Janet Mefford Today podcast is sponsored by Heart for Lebanon, the Christian ministry working among 2 million Syrian refugee families who've been displaced. For just $29 a month, you can help Heart for Lebanon reach out in Jesus' name to a family of six, providing them with food, Christian education, survival essentials, and the gospel. Please call now, 888-247-5499. That's 888-247-5499 or janetmefford.com. We are back on Janet Mefford Today. Well, the Republican Study Committee this week unveiled a health care plan to replace Obamacare. It is a 66-page framework that seeks to transform the individual marketplace's current regulatory structure, unwind the ACA's Washington-centric approach, and largely return regulatory authority to individual states. Fox News notes it includes provisions to increase the portability of health insurance within the individual marketplace, provide federal funding for state-designed guaranteed coverage pools, and promote innovative care, such as telemedicine. What should we make of it, though? We're going to get some thoughts on it now from Matt Bellis, who is Chief Communications Officer for Liberty HealthShare, a national nonprofit healthcare sharing ministry. So good to talk to you again, Matt. How are you today?
Thank you for having me, Janet. Doing well.
Good. Well, you know, there always is news about Obamacare, as we know very, very well. What do you make of this? I mean, you guys are kind of outside that whole structure, but looking from an outsider's perspective at this new health care plan, what do you think about it?
Well, from a 30,000-foot view, it definitely is something that is necessary, primarily because a lot of people have seen the problems within government intervention into more of our health care. And so any attempts or things that we can do as a nation to strip back a lot of that bureaucracy that on one hand are so many promises, but on the other hand come with so many detriments, it is a good thing to pull that back, rein it in, bring some more sanity back to the health care marketplace, because there's so many things wrong with it at this moment. But I do have to say, a lot of people out there are looking for that silver bullet method, that one thing that's going to fix everything. Yeah. And with a system as complicated as the healthcare marketplace in this country, you're not going to find a single silver bullet that's actually going to fix things. Some people look at technology, things like you were talking about, telemedicine. Or other options available to people right now these days because the technology has gotten so much better.
Right.
Other people are looking at HSAs, health savings accounts, HRAs, health reimbursement accounts or arrangements. You know, all of these different financial institutions that are trying to find ways to do it. The whole crux of the matter can really be understood in the system of third-party payment.
Right.
When you have somebody else who is in charge and power of the purse strings is taken away from the individual patient, that's where you start to see a lot of the major issues with healthcare and how it's administered and how it's paid for. We do have a very good healthcare system, but the way that we pay for it is really, really, truly broken. And until we start stripping that back even more, and allowing for more patient freedom and patient control, we're not going to see the big dramatic gains within the marketplace to drive the cost of healthcare down and increase the accessibility.
Yeah.
So while I applaud pulling back, I wish they would do more.
Oh, yeah, you and me both. You and me both. Well, we all know the passage of Obamacare was really a turning point for a lot of people in seeking out a lower cost solution to paying for health expenses. How has Liberty HealthShare fit into that equation, Matt?
Well, as Liberty HealthShare, we are not insurance. We don't want to be a part of insurance. We're not that at all. We're a community of like-minded individuals who have gathered together around specific principles to share in each other's medical expenses. We're all each individually self-pay patients. We are responsible for our own health, healthcare, and healthcare bills. Yet during those times that are unexpected and unaffordable, that's when the community comes together to really share in each other's medical expenses. And we do that without the aid of another third-party insurance or the government. We do that as a community together, and it has provided to be very successful for our members. So we're not a part of that whole system. We're a system all into our own, and we wouldn't have it any other way.
Right. Well, and many people will go back and understand what was put into place with the ACA or Obamacare, as we like to call around here, were a lot of rules and regulations. I mean, even Nancy Pelosi said you got to pass it in order to read it and know what's in it. We remember all of that. But, you know, it's interesting. Many people will ask the question, how is it that you can have a, you know, nonprofit healthcare sharing ministry when the government is getting more involved? But this goes back to the fact that you guys were given a carve out, right? This is absolutely legal under Obamacare. And a lot of people are still surprised to hear that.
Well, it is interesting because a lot of people don't understand that there's a little section within the ACA in section 1501-B, in case you want to take a look at it, where it does carve out an area for members of healthcare sharing ministries to be exempt from the fines and mandates of the Affordable Care Act. It was something that, thankfully, it was a Democrat senator, Senator Max Baucus, who saw that healthcare sharing ministries were working and doing fine all on their own, and they didn't need government intervention. So they defined it. They have a system where they are able to recognize healthcare sharing ministries, and those members are exempt from those fines and mandates. Now, a lot of those fines have gone away for 2019, but whatever the government giveth, the government also taketh away, so we don't know what could happen in the future. But you're right. It is a way for people of conscience who want to be a part of a community like this to exempt themselves from the ACA.
What would you say are the main differences between private health insurance or Obamacare being on the exchanges, just insurance in general, and Liberty Health Share? What would be the main differences when people leave behind that third-party payer system and go to Liberty Health Share and pay, you know, become a self-pay patient and have more freedom?
Well, this could take an hour, so sit back.
Briefly,
I'll take it briefly, absolutely. Well, there's really two major differences. One, we do not spread risk. That whole issue with insurance where you're spreading the risk as much as possible so that it becomes affordable, that's not what we do. We are all individually responsible for our own medical bills. The other thing that we don't do is we don't pool our funds. We don't put our money into what I affectionately call a bureaucratic black hole, where hopefully you might be able to get some money back out of it at some point. All our money is each individually our own, and we do not spread the risk of our medical bills. We're all each individually responsible. But during those times that are unexpected and unaffordable, that's when the community comes together to share those medical expenses that each one of us has. It's not an insurance system. Think of it more like a community, because it would be your neighbors, your friends, your family, your church even, that you would turn to in those times of need where you would gain support for the things that you have. And so we've just systematized it. We've just taken that whole process, put some technology behind it, made it more efficient, and we have a complete system that is wholly separate from insurance, and we're so glad that we have it this way.
Right. So when you have a doctor expense or a hospital expense, something like that, how do those bills get paid?
Well, what happens then, the doctor or hospital sends the bills through our system, and Liberty Health Share aggregates the relationships and sends the money where it needs to be. Each every month, you send in what's called a share amount. That share amount is directed by Liberty Health Share to another member who has a need. And Liberty Health Share makes sure that you're paying for the least amount for the greatest care. So we make sure, go through all of our processes, our negotiations, and everything to ensure that it is a fair and reasonable bill. But Liberty HealthShare takes care of that all on the back end, because we want you to focus on the front end of making good decisions, directing your health care, and working with your doctors.
Very good. And what about deductibles and co-pays? How does that work?
Well, we don't work in a system of deductibles and co-pays. All of our things that we do derive from our sharing model, but we do have areas where whenever you have a medical bill, you have what we call an annual unshared amount. It's the amount of money that you pay before sharing begins. So if for a single, it'd be $1,000. For a couple, $1,750. And for a family of three or more, it would be $2,250. And we don't have co-pays because you're not co-paying an insurance. to go see your doctor. So those are the kinds of things that we do pay for as a as an individual.
Very good. Well, you can check out libertyhealthshare.org, libertyhealthshare.org. Matt Ballas with us. Always good to talk to you, Matt. Thank you so much for stopping by. Great to be with you, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right. You take care, and we'll be right back on Janet Mefford Today. Hi, this is Janet Mefford, and I want to tell you about a 10-year-old Syrian girl named Hanifa. Hanifa lost her mother when she was just 18 months old, and now she lives in a refugee camp in Lebanon. She's smart, she's vivacious, and she's seen more suffering than a child her age should ever see, all because she's a victim of what the UN calls the worst humanitarian crisis since World War II. But because Heart for Lebanon is on the ground in her camp, Hanifa recently placed her faith and trust in Jesus for salvation, and now because her father is illiterate, she's reading the Bible to him every evening. The Lord is using Heart for Lebanon in a powerful way. They're bringing food, survival essentials, and Christian education to girls like Hanifa and their families. And these families are coming to know the Lord. But Heart for Lebanon needs your help to keep helping the desperate. Right now, you can help rescue a family of six in Lebanon with food, Christian education, and survival essentials for just 98 cents a day. That's just $29 a month. All you have to do to help is to call now, 888-247-5499. That's 888-247-5499. Or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. The war in Syria is not over. And even if the war stopped today, the UN estimates it will take 50 years to rebuild the country. Jesus said the harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. The Lord has sent the workers of Heart for Lebanon into his harvest field, but they need the help of other Christians to keep on doing what they're doing. We need your help. $29 a month will help rescue a family of six. All you have to do is call now, 888-247-5499. That's 888-247-5499. Or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. These families need your immediate help. Please pick up the phone and call. 888-247-5499. 888-247-5499. Thank you, and God bless. We are back on Janet Mefford Today. I have rarely gotten so upset by looking at something on the news or watching something on the news as I have with this video that is now out of 7-year-old James Younger. We have talked about this story, not just this week, but I've talked about it before. We played some cuts, I know, of the father talking at the Texas State Capitol about this case. Boy, several months back, it's been a while. But if you're just tuning in and you don't know what's going on, there is a 7-year-old boy in the state of Texas by the name of James Younger. His parents are divorced. The mother is a pediatrician. The father and the mother are at absolute war over this little boy because the mother is pushing for him to have chemical castration and transition to becoming a girl. The father has claimed that the little boy is very masculine when he's with him and has no interest in anything having to do with any feminine activities whatsoever. He doesn't want to dress up as a girl. He doesn't talk about being a girl. And it's his theory that this is all being pushed on him by the mother. Now, there was a hearing just a few days ago, and a jury in Dallas decided to give sole custody of this little boy to the mother. Can you imagine? To the mother. Now, let me play for you this video that has just come out of this little boy. He's being interviewed. I'm not entirely sure who the interviewer is, if it's his father or maybe somebody else in the family or a medical provider. I'm not sure who it is. What really matters in the back and forth is what the little boy says. So listen to this heartbreaking clip. This is cut one.
You're a boy, right?
No, I'm a girl.
Who told you you're a girl?
Mommy.
When did she tell you you were a girl?
Because I love girls.
Oh, I see. So mommy told you you're a girl?
Uh-huh.
Does mommy do anything else, like with a girl with you?
Mm-hmm.
Like what?
Like dresses.
What does she do?
She do puts them on me.
She puts dresses on you? Oh, wow. And what else does she do?
She buys my headbands.
Uh-huh.
And and she gave me hair clips.
Oh, hair clips? Okay. Mm-hmm. What else?
Some microphones.
What else?
Like a skeleton.
Does she do anything with your fingers?
Yeah.
What?
She paints my nails.
So that, why does she do that?
Because I love my nail polish.
Oh. So mommy puts you in a dress and puts nail polish on you?
Mm-hmm.
And what does mommy tell you?
She tells me I'm a girl.
Oh, okay. Do you think you're a girl?
Uh-huh.
You do? Is that why you wear this, so that you can have long hair?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Can you even believe that? How sick this is. What mother would do that to her little boy? Dressing him up in dresses, putting nail polish on his fingernails. This woman shouldn't be anywhere near this little boy, in my opinion. She should not have custody of him at all. This is sick child abuse. And I cannot imagine what that father is going through, trying to protect his little boy from this transgender activism that this woman is pushing on her little son. It's sickening to listen to that. And did you hear right at the beginning of the clip when he was saying, I love girls? Did anybody notice that? I love girls. That's a normal thing that little boys say, isn't it? And older boys, especially older boys. I love girls. I love girls. Well, little boys do love girls. That's natural. That's what's normal. If he loves girls and somehow she thinks that means he wants to be one, do you even understand the concept of being a mother, being a parent? What kind of mother would want to do that to her little boy? And not only that, but it's outrageous to look at this case and say, how in the world can you give sole custody to this woman who wants to destroy this kid's life and the father doesn't even get a say in it? He's the father. How does he not have equal say? And it would seem to me that the prurient thing to do would be, if you have a disagreement between divorced parents on what should happen to the little boy, you do what is least offensive. You do less. You don't do more. In other words, if she is bound and determined to put him through chemical castration, which, by the way, ought to be against the law, period, end of story. Every state in the union, as I said a few days ago, should have a law on the books that says no child under the age of 18 can be touched for any reason concerning bodily mutilation or chemicals, hormones, whatever. No kid should be touched, especially when we know how many kids are confused. They're little kids. What in the world is going on? But they should do less. They should say, in the circumstances that we have before us where the mother wants to do something severe, the father doesn't want to do anything, let's hold off. Let's take a wait and see approach. And it appears from what has been written about this case that just went before the court recently, that that was one of the things on the table, that they should do kind of a wait and watch routine. And 11 out of 12 jurors, no, give sole custody to the mother. What is wrong with people? What is wrong with people? There were people actually on social media who were saying, I wouldn't blame this father one bit if he kidnapped his kid and took off across the country and left and went into hiding for the rest of his life to protect his son. And you can certainly understand that from an emotional point of view. Can you imagine being in that circumstance? If you were divorcing and your spouse, your ex-spouse, wanted to turn your little boy into a girl? I don't even want to think about what I would do. Of course, my husband is completely normal and we're not divorcing. But in any case, he would never do anything like that. But it's crazy. The one upside, I think, to all of this, well, there are a couple of upsides. One of the upsides is that Texas Governor Greg Abbott has already said that the state is looking into this. The Attorney General's Office and Department of Family and Protective Services are now examining this case, as well they should. That boy should not be in the custody of that woman. I'm sorry. Period. End of story. That's the good thing. But there's another part of this that I think will be an upside, and it's this. Perhaps this will be the moment where millions of Americans wake up and say, this LGBT agenda is out of control. This is insanity. This is demonic, which it is. You know, in fact, there was a story here. This is kind of weird, in my opinion. But there was a story in the Washington Examiner. I don't know this man, Brad Palumbo, but it sounds from this story that he may be a homosexual himself. But the headline here is, gay rights depend on our rejecting transgender radicalism and standing up for James Younger. And he is making the argument that a 7-year-old boy cannot be transgender, at least not with anywhere near the certainty necessary to justify taking steps toward life-altering, potentially irreversible physical changes such as hormone therapy or puberty blockers. Okay, even if you do think you're the opposite sex, nobody should be going through that, period. Not kids, not teenagers, not adults. This stance against chemically castrating young children is now considered radical and abusive rather than obvious common sense at the fringes of the transgender movement. A Texas court now, as I mentioned, has denied the father custody of his children and goes into a little bit of that. And this writer says this is insane and has understandably led to conservative backlash and widespread denunciation. As Kaylee McGee observes, this is the logical conclusion of the transgender movement. Affirm our agenda or lose your rights to freedom of speech, association, conscience, and even your parental rights. And this goes back to how woke you are. But then he says, you know, do gay people really want our rights tied to a movement that would mutilate any child who strays from gender stereotypes? If this is what the T in LGBT advocates for, I want absolutely nothing to do with it. In fact, such an association clearly undermines the very case for gay equality. Well, I would make an argument that is not that argument. Because if this man is homosexual, then he has a vested interest in so-called gay rights. The entire movement needs to be thrown out. Period. And I know that won't happen. That's not where we are in history. And I'm not trying to deny any American constitutional rights to anybody. But I am one of those people who has said from day one, you don't create a special class of rights for people based on their sexual preferences. It's insane. So we opened this Pandora's box several years ago when we started messing with the redefinition of marriage. It started way before that, but it was codified in the Obergefell v. Hodges decision at the Supreme Court. And now this is what you get when you start going into to some kind of Gnostic understanding of what it means to be a human being, and you start calling marriage what is sin, then where do you think you're going to end up? Where do you think you're going to end up? You've got drag queens and their boas and their brightly colored dresses reading to toddlers in local libraries. Gee, where are you on this whole story? You know, you who think gay rights is fine. Why don't you talk about that? There are all kinds of extreme things going on. But it all started with a homosexual rights agenda. That's who's pushing this. Who is pushing the transgender agenda, so-called? The Human Rights Campaign. And they're the biggest gay lobby group on earth. You think those people are going to retract what they've said? There's not a chance in the world they're going to retract what they've said. None at all. And the progressive movement and the radicals and the Democrats are all in on this stuff. It is too late to stuff it back into Pandora's box. And the way that you get off this agenda is you reject it utterly. And you say, this is not how God designed people to be. We need to return to the sanity of male-female, the sanity of natural relations between men and women in the covenant of marriage, and the nuclear family, whereby parents can love and protect the children that God has entrusted to them. It's the only way we will survive as a culture, in my view. We're out of time. Thanks for joining us here on Janet Meffer today, and we will see you next time.